We're pleased to have Professor Srinivas with us this afternoon. He came to Cambridge from the University of Mysore for this term to give the Fraser Lecture, and we thought we would take the opportunity of his presence here of getting him to talk a little about his own career in social anthropology, both in relationship to the people he met and in relationship to the problems with which he himself dealt, and particularly perhaps saying how much social anthropology had changed or not changed in India during the years he had been associated with it. I first met Professor Srinivas at Oxford in the distant past, but before that he had been a student at Bombay, so perhaps I might ask you to begin in that ambiance.
I went to Bombay in the 30s from Mysore because my teachers in Mysore had advised me that the best sociologist in India was then teaching in Bombay, and he was Gurie. And Gurie, incidentally, was perhaps one of the last students of Rivers in Cambridge. I went to Gurie very raw and immature and perhaps opinionated young man. And I told Gurie, I think, that I wanted to write two volumes on Indian sociology. He smiled and said, "You will do that." And then he asked me to do a dissertation on marriage and family among the Kannada castes in Mysore. I think he found me too much out of touch with facts, and he wanted to teach me some respect for facts. And I did this dissertation largely out of gazetteers and volumes on tribes and castes, eked out with some fieldwork. And the fieldwork portion was quite interesting. It was even exciting, as I remember now. And I got my master's, and then I proceeded to do a PhD on the Kurgs of South India with Gurie. Mm-hmm. This was a thesis based on field work. And Kurg in those days, this was during World War II, in those days was still somewhat cut off. We had buses from Mysore to the capital, Makera, and beyond. But Kurg was quite a wild country in those days, and with very few restaurants or hotels, and I had to stay in the homes of friends to do my field work. And as it happened, I came down with some very severe stomach trouble, and this destroyed any notions I had of staying in a Kurg village and seeing everything for myself. So after I had been treated for my stomach trouble, I used to pay visits to Makera, and from there go to the interior, witness ceremonies and visit temples, talk to people, and this was how the material was gathered. I spent several weeks in Makera, and I was lucky enough to came across a very learned and also very well-informed Kurg, who taught me about the language, the customs, beliefs, etc. And he also helped me translate some of the Kurg folklore I had collected. And the result of my efforts was somewhat heavy thesis, about 900 pages, if I remember rightly, and I submitted it to the University of Bombay in 1944, and I think I didn't collect my degree. I got it in 45, sometime in 45. And from Bombay I came to Oxford on the recommendation of Gurie, who told me that unlike Malinowski, Ratley Brown was a seeded functionalist. And it is interesting because Ratley Brown was, I think, the first student of Rivers at Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
So I came to Oxford in May 1945, and Ratley Brown had returned a few months previously from a rather extended stay in São Paulo in Brazil, and the subject of my PhD dissertation was not approved by him. I had chosen as the subject of my dissertation an examination of the concept of patterns of culture by Ruth Benedict, taking material from three South Indian tribes or marginal groups, two of them being Todas and Chenchus, I think. I'm not sure about the second. And the third one being, of course, my Kurgs. Ratley Brown did not like Ruth Benedict's approach, thought her highly unscientific, but I wanted to stick up for my choice of theme. I think he was very patient with me, and before he went for the summer vacation, he said, if you want to work on patterns of culture, write me a long paper on it during the long vacation, and then we shall decide during the coming Michaelmas term. I worked quite hard during that summer vacation and produced a paper of sorts, and I gave it to Ratley Brown to read. A few days afterwards, he returned the paper to me and said, "It's all right. You can go on and work on patterns of culture." I had won my point, but I could see that he was not very happy about it. I then asked him, "Look, what exactly do you think about my theme? Do you think it's useful for me to work on it now that I've been given the, you know, permission by you to work on it? What do you think of it?" He said, I remember the words, "It's a waste of time for a man of your talents to spend any time on Ruth Benedict." And I said, "What shall I do then?" Then I had forgotten the fact that I had burned the poor man with these two volumes of mine to take home with him to Wales for the summer vacation. He said, "I've just been looking at your Cook thesis. Did you go to an English school?" I said, "No, I went to a neighborhood school." Then he said something very highly complimentary about my written English and said, "There is wonderful material here. Why don't you look at this material from the functionalist point of view?" I said, "Look, I do not have the funds to make another field trip to Coog. It will be very expensive and it's beyond my means." He said, "You need go to Coog. There's plenty of material here. Why don't you look at it? You can register yourself for a PhD." So I registered for myself for a PhD with the title, "The Social Function of Religion in a South Indian Community." South Indian Community. And that is how the Kurg book came to be written. R.B. Insisted that I read, very rightly, Fustil de Coulanges. He was a great admirer of Fustil de Coulanges. What's that book?
The Ancient City.
Ancient City, Durkheim and Bateson. And then, of course, E.P.'s Azande volume and the Nua. I read, of course, R.B.'s own writings, The Andaman Islanders, and so on. And I really worked hard. I looked at my data from the functionalist point of view, and suddenly it started falling in place. I may add here that Gourier was still committed to Rivers's ideas in his last phase. I think Rivers in 1922 had formed a kind of a triumvirate with Perry and Elliot Smith. Mm-hmm. And they have diffusionists of a very wild sort, saying that human creativity is limited, and all the good ideas, or some of the best ideas, did occur in ancient Egypt, and then they traveled to the rest of the world. And I wrote my Kurg book under this unfortunate theoretical framework, if I may call it that. And I discovered, I was extremely dissatisfied with the result of my efforts. Ultimately, it came to where did the Kurgs come from, you see. Some people had brought them in from the Gulf countries, as they are called now. Some others had brought them in from Central Asia. And the Kurgs themselves, they knew about both these hypotheses. And one knowledgeable Kurg would favor the Gulf states, another Central Asia, you see. I think both of them based on an equal measure of ignorance. I looked for some physical anthropological data. All that I know about them is that they have extreme brachycephalism amongst them, you see. And this, I think, posed a problem to the people who were swearing that they were Aryans. And I turned to Haddon's Races of Mankind, or Races of Man, I think there's a book called that. And I found Haddon had introduced a second migration of Aryans in the second edition of his Races of Man, without informing that it was a new edition, you see. I'm mentioning all this because this kind of diffusionism was a guessing game, and I was fed up with it, you see. I told myself, go to Oxford. If I can't do any, if I can't get to a sociology which is more definitive, then I'm going to quit the field and do something else, you see. And R.B.'s functionalism came to me really, was extremely helpful. And looking at the Kurg material from a Durkheimian and R.B. point of view, I found it made a lot of sense to me, you see. At last, I had come to a sociology which was on the one hand related to empirical data, on the other hand, it produce some theoretical insights into Indian culture and society. I felt I had come home, and this is why I feel that, nowadays Ratley Brown's reputation is not very high, particularly in England. I think people do not know the kind of importance his ideas had at the time he came on the scene. He came on the scene when Rivers, who was then extremely influential, along with Grafton, Elliot Smith, and Perry, had embraced this wild functionalism. And I think R.B. on the one hand and Malinowski on the other were a welcome corrective.
Mm-hmm. You want me to go on?
Yeah, like yes. But Gourier, he wasn't influenced at all by Rivers' other interest, because Rivers, of course, was not only interested in diffusionism. His book on social organization was a very interesting analytical volume, which, in a sense, influenced Ratcliffe Brown himself there.
On that, there are 2 points I'd like to make. One is that it was Gurdjieff who made me read his copy of Kinship and Social Organization.
It was, yes.
There were a few lectures meant to be given at Calcutta or somewhere. You see. Anyway, I read them. And yes. Gurdjieff himself was deeply interested in the field of kinship, an interest which he pursued for a long time. And he has written a paper on dual organization in India. This interest was there. I think about social, what is the other book? Social Organization? Yeah, isn't that?
Yes.
Social Organization, he was a bit more, bit less enthusiastic, let me put it that way. Arby, on the other hand, was quite enthusiastic about social organization. He told me that he could point to passages in Social Organization which Rivers had rewritten to answer criticisms by Arby. So Arby...
you mean Rivers had given the manuscript to Radcliffe Brown to read?
Yeah, and Radcliffe Brown was convinced that had Rivers lived to lived longer, he would have seen the light and been converted to RB and Durkheimian functionalism. This is a very interesting thing. And social organization, I think, Rivers comes closest to being a sociologist, I would say. And it was obvious that to me that RB had been in touch with Rivers. As to the extent of the influence RB wielded on Rivers in his last phase, this is a matter for research.
Did Gurdjieff dominate Indian anthropology at that time?
Oh, actually, Gurdjieff, I would say, was probably is probably the single most important influence in Indian sociology and anthropology. And one of the good things in India is you can be a sociologist and do anthropological work, and you can be a social anthropologist and do sociological work. And this is one of the main factors in it is the influence of Gurdjieff. Because Gurdjieff, he could write on the disposal of the human placenta in India, you know, that was one of his interests. And then Indo-European kinship on the other. And he could also write about cities, about sadhus, about caste and race in India. So he was kind of, polymath. And his... basic training had been in Sanskrit. He got his master's in Sanskrit, and Bombay then had a very good tradition in Sanskrit learning and teaching. And I think Gurdjieff got the Chancellor's Medal. And then he came under the influence of Patrick Geddes, who was appointed in 1914 as the director of the School of Economics and Sociology in Bombay for some odd reason. He was brought in and given charge of a research institution with not emphasis on, day-to-day teaching. And this was one of the best things that happened in the social sciences in India. Gurdjieff, after a year with Geddes, he went to Hobhouse in London and found Hobhouse monumentally dull. So he left him after 6 months, I think 6 months or a year, and then came to Cambridge, where he came under the influence of Rivers and Haddon. And then, he was completely overwhelmed by Rivers' personality. And he told me that after meeting Rivers, he was walking along maybe Trinity Street, and he saw a copy of Rivers' latest publication, Instinct and the Unconscious. And then he read it, and he told Rivers he had read it, and he asked Gurdjieff what he thought of it. Gurdjieff said, it's very good, but it is mechanistic, which I thought was very, you need a lot of, spunk to tell a man like Rivers that your book is mechanistic, when you have just come from India and so on. Apparently, this made Rivers like Gurdjieff, and Gurdjieff... he allowed Gurdjieff to submit a couple of papers, long papers for his PhD. And Gurdjieff told me that one of the one of the disasters in his life was to see St. John's flag flying half-mast one morning, and Rivers had died suddenly on the operating table of strangulated hernia. And Rivers felt orphaned, as he told me. But apparently Rivers had spoken to Haddon about Gurrier, and Gurrier finished his thesis and got back to Bombay to the, as it then was, the School of Economics and Sociology. And subsequently, though he himself was an armchair sociologist, he built up a sociological tradition based on field work. He knew that India had started to change in a big way, and he would get his students to, on the one hand, to dig up data from tribes and castes reports, gazetteers, travelers' accounts, etc., etc., and on the other, to do field work. But I think I was probably one of these students, I was probably one of those whom he wanted to go in for intensive field work. I remember receiving a letter from him in the field when I told him that I had gathered, you know, I think I was given to bragging. I said I had gathered a tremendous amount of data. He wrote me back promptly saying, "Remember Malinowski, you see." I think it was a gentle but a very firm snub. And, you know, it taught me the virtues of modesty, I think. I think I have done with Gurrier. And Gurrier said that Ratcliffe Brown was the person I should go to. I think he found Malinowski. He didn't like Malinowski, partly because Malinowski was so critical of Rivers, I think. Whereas Ratcliffe Brown had been, you know, it is the... this kind of bond is recognized in Indian learning. If you are the student of the same teacher, you are called Guru Bhai. That is...
Brothers in the same guru.
Guru.
Yes, yes.
So he recommended me to his guru bhai. And,
yes.
And then Abhi left Oxford in, 46 July. And then he recommended me to E.P. He told E.P. that he should take me on. And it was under E.P. I finished my thesis on the Kurgs, and E.P. threw a lot of cold water on Durkheim. I think E.P. thought that I was too enthusiastic in my embrace of functionalism, and he wanted to gently introduce some skepticism into my, you know, into my frame of mind, which I think he did succeed over a longer period of time. But I found that E.P.'s, E.P. poo-pooed Durkheim, but if you read his Newer Religion and see his chapter on Newer Sacrifice, he takes a tremendous amount from Durkheim. I think E.P. at that phase in his life was rejecting Durkheim because of his determinism, but it did not mean that he rejected the sounder portions in Durkheim's sociology. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I got my degree in July 47, and E.P. was present at when I was conferred the degree, because I was his first PhD baby in Oxford. So I have the, you know, I was in essence the last student of R.B. in Oxford and the first of E.P. And it was E.P. who created a job for me in Oxford as university lecturer in Indian sociology. And one of the attractions of the job was, I got this letter when I was in India. He gave the first year of my job, he told me that I could spend a year doing field work in an Indian village, because I had told him that I felt very keenly the lack of really intensive field work, the lack of experience of really intensive field work. And he said, "Why don't you do it while you are there instead of coming here and then going back after a year?" So I was delighted with this offer, and it is really
it illustrates how thoughtful E.P. could be when it came to action, when it came to helping a younger colleague, student. And I regard my 10.5 months in Rampura as probably one of the most important periods in my life, because I did do fairly serious intensive field work, and my whole knowledge of India in a sense underwent a change as a result of this experience. It is because of that that I am an ardent advocate of experience of intensive field work, whether one is doing social anthropology or sociology in India. And this is particularly necessary for Indians, because by and large the kind of students who come into higher learning in India, whether it's social anthropology or physics, come from the urban middle classes and upper castes, and they have very little knowledge of India. In fact, very little knowledge, except in the case of some students coming from traditional groups, very little knowledge of their traditional culture, and still less of rural areas. And finally, living in a caste come class society, you unconsciously imbibe certain negative attitude towards the culture of lower groups. And one way of getting all this negative stuff out of them is to send them to a village or tribe or urban slum. And I don't know if any of you have seen a book which I edited along with two of my colleagues 2 years ago, mm-hmm. The Field Worker in the Field. It consists of 18 statements of intensive field experiences in different settings. 15 of them are 16 of them are based on Indian experience, and they include not only working in village India and tribal India, but also urban slums, factories, trade unions, politics in small town politics, an Ari Samaj neighborhood unit, the range and diversity of the experience, going into a matrilineal area in a very traditional part of Palghat in southern Kerala. So the range of experience is astonishing, and I would make it compulsory reading for anybody taking up social anthropology or sociology, not because I'm one of its editors, but I do think that Indian students particularly need to be brought out of their domestic and caste and sectarian shells to appreciate this this richness and diversity of Indian culture, and also much more important, to see that multiplicity of perceptions is basic to Indian society and culture. I don't know if I'm making sense to you, but
how have you managed in India? You said that it was partly due to Gurier, that you have, in a sense, this overlapping this overlapping fields of sociology and social anthropology. And I think it's significant that you said yourself that you found Radcliffe Brown an interesting from the standpoint of here you came across a true sociology. It's significant too, I think, that your lectureship in Oxford was a lectureship in Indian sociology. Now, although we have got this tradition, I think, and Radcliffe Brown himself spoke of comparative sociology, and when anyone asks me what I am, I speak in the same kind of terms. On the other hand, it's a very difficult situation to maintain, because the sort of polarization takes place. Anthropologists inevitably get stigmatized, as they do in current disputes of this country, as Blue Lagoon anthropologists. And students themselves sort of see two channels, you know, one which involves going to far-off places and blue lagoons, and the other which involves working in your slum areas. We get, I think, too little of the latter nowadays. What is it, how have you managed to keep some kind of balance, overlap? I mean, how have you managed to achieve this greater overlap in India? Because in many other countries, there has been this greater polarity, really, that's taken place, you think, with sort of sociology as being defined as, you know, the here and now, the active part of things, with social anthropology being involved in rural areas, more historic problems, and so on and so forth. I mean,
Well, not that the second variety of sociology is not present in India. I mean, you do get, especially students who have been to American universities and got their PhD there, they use survey research techniques, and they use sampling and statistical methods and techniques much more than the anthropologists, and they are also able to produce books and papers there's more of it in India than from social anthropologists proper. And this kind of sociology is often put in opposition to social anthropology by the practitioners of sociology. And I've had the distinction of being disowned both by sociologists and social anthropologists in India.
That's a very honorable position to
be in. But there are certain tendencies, or rather features in Indian culture itself, which enable you to, which force you to come out of your preoccupation with tribes or with urban people and to go back into history. For instance, Gurye's own influence is very significant in this connection. And the fact that traditional life is so prominent in Indian life, mm-hmm. and if you are investigating any section of Indian life, you come into contact with the book dimension, as I call it, with the scriptural dimension, mm-hmm. and you come into contact with ritual specialists, and you go to pilgrim centers where they have your genealogical records. So the past is ever present in India, mm-hmm. if I may say so. Mm-hmm. So you can't make a hard and fast distinction. And this is one of the factors which makes it very difficult to divide the field neatly between anthropologists and sociologists. And not only Gurye, but some of the other sociologists, Chattopadhyay, who was also a student of Rivers in Calcutta, and N.K. Bose. N.K. Bose, for instance, studied tribals, and he also studied coronation rituals in Orissa. He didn't publish much, though. But this toing and froing between tribes and aspects of traditional culture, mm-hmm. studying pilgrimage centers and so on. So the presence of tradition in a very strong and in a very live manner in Indian culture is certainly a factor, I think. And mm-hmm. apart from it, I have, you know, another idea which I find very useful, another idea of Ratcliffe Brown's, is this concept of comparative sociology. The only thing is it's not practiced anywhere, but it's useful as in polemics to when you're fighting for the right kind of sociology or anthropology, to call yourself a comparative sociology, which ideally includes all societies in space and time. Mm-hmm. And that is to say, you can work, for instance, in ancient India. I mean, you can discussed the role of Buddhism in ancient Indian society or Jainism in ancient Indian society. And one of Arvind Shah, for instance, who has done probably one of the best studies of best village studies in India. He did study a multi-caste village in Kheda district, and he is deeply interested in history, and he has written several papers in what I call sociological history, and he is bringing out a collection of his papers in sociological on sociological history, with the special area being Gujarat. So I would argue for comparative sociology, and this also enables me to have a dialogue with historians, with demographers, with economic historians and others. Mm-hmm. And I think sociology, as it is developing in India, has a continuing dialogue with these people. It's not enough. I think we should have more of that dialogue. And on the other hand, you have linkages with within quotes, Indologists, Sanskritists, and specialists in specialists on Buddhism, Jainism, and so on. So as I see it, you have to work with the social sciences, and you have to work with the Indologists, and you also are interested in tribes, and many of these tribes have some Hindu traits in them. You remember one of the criticisms of Mao's, I don't know how justified it is, of Rivers' work on the Todas is that Rivers ignores the influence of Hinduism on the Todas, you see. When these tribes live cheek by jowl with Hindus, there's a continuous interaction between the two. There is not only Hinduization of tribal groups, but at the lower levels of Hindu society itself, tribal elements are quite strong. I mean, we can't ignore this element. Apart from it, historically speaking, many of the dominant castes of India have come from the ranks of tribes. So given such a culture civilization, I think any kind of sharp differentiation between sociologists who study sectors of urban society and anthropologists who study tribes would be artificial, and
I think that's true, but on the other hand, it has been possible elsewhere, and when you think of it's interesting that it hasn't happened in India, whereas I can remember a few years ago when André Bette was visiting here, doing his best to persuade Dr. Humphrey and I to get people to go to the sort of central areas of Hinduism rather than going up to the tribes, because I think we found that colleagues who worked in Nepal are not here, but either they wanted to go to some peripheral area of India or else they wanted to go into tribal areas. And after all, Rector Brown himself worked in the Andaman Islanders, which was hardly a central area of Indian experience. There was a lot of push, I think, still for that. And it's very interesting, I think, that Indian anthropology has not done that.
One of the distinctive things about Indian anthropology is that so many members of the profession work on their own culture. I mean, that breaks down the barrier.
What was your relationship with Coorg and Rampur?
My relationship with Coorg, unfortunately, I visited it incognito a few years ago. But I really want to go there once, announcing that Coorgs know about me.
No, I really meant taking up. I was taking up Stephen's point there. You weren't going back to your own culture in Coorg.
So how, in a sense, I suppose there seem to be a lot of difficulties about working in your own culture. At least that's part of the set of beliefs I think that we labour under, namely that one doesn't have perhaps the perspective that one would in working as an outsider. Secondly, perhaps there would be actual difficulties working as a participant, observer, in a circumstance in which one isn't, one is already a part of the system. Are these difficulties that beset you, or is it because Indian society is so fragmented, and since one's always an outsider, there's no...
Let me put it this way. There are difficulties for the insider, and a certain amount of discipline let me put it differently. An anthropologist should have experience of a different culture before he gets to his own. But then India is, you said fragmented, I would look at it differently. So rich in diversity. When you send somebody in Bombay to a tribe in Kerala, you are not sending him to his own culture, you see. I mean, this tribe is really very backward, and its lifestyle is so completely different from that of a Bombay youth or Calcutta youth. Or you needn't even go that far. You take a student in Bangalore and take him 10 miles away. If he's a Kannada speaker, you can take him to the Telugu area. If he's a Tamil speaker, you can take him into the Kannada area, because Bangalore is a tri-junction of Kannada, Telugu, and Tamil. So, in fact, you can do a lot of backyard anthropology in India. It is so rich in diversity that you are at once a stranger. And you and the surprises you get, if one is sufficiently reflective, and I hope anthropology students are sufficiently reflective, that is, you tell yourself after a while, I thought I knew this culture, but I don't know anything about it. Let me tell you a thing that happened to me. This was not my first fieldwork. This was really my second fieldwork, after I had done my Coorg fieldwork. And Rampura is only 22 miles from Mysore. And during the summer of 1948, there was a protracted drought. And in this part of Mysore, you do get odd rains, a couple of rains. You are supposed to get them in the middle of May. Middle of April, I mean. There were no rains, and then the summer sowings were affected by it. And every day, this was the main topic of conversation, you know, when is it going to rain? And then they used to ask everybody for signs of rain and so on. I won't go into it. But after a while, I mean, when it was close to May, I think, they decided to go and consult one of the deities in the village about the prospects for rain. And the deity in question is in the form of a stone bull. The stone bull represents Nandi, which is the vehicle of Shiva. And Nandi in this part of India is associated with cattle, with agriculture, with fodder, the whole lot. It's a very, very relevant deity to the peasants of this region. And I was told about it, and I accompanied the party of elders, village elders, who went to consult the deity. And I thought they would have some, pray respectfully, and ask. I didn't know how the deity would give an answer, and they told me that the deity would answer their query. We went there, it was a very warm day, very hot, and then it's a stone temple, and we got in with no windows, and then there was this deity with, you know, flowers had been arranged on it, and there was a priest, a very elderly Lingayat priest. He waved the camphor around it thrice, and then the audience sat, and they were to make the request. And the leader of the delegation, a man in his 70s then, he said, in a very matter-of-fact way, come on, give us an answer, you see, addressing the stone image, you see. I was taken aback. I was wondering how the answer would be given. somebody explained to me that if one of the arranged flowers on the right side fell, it meant an S. And if another flower on the left side fell, it meant no. And one of them told me, on occasion you will even see a flower being flung at you, you see. I was waiting for the flower to be flung at me. And nothing happened, you see. And the peasants became very angry. And then this elder barked at the deity. What do you think, who do you think we are, you see? We are not ordinary people, we are important people, you see. We have come to ask you a question. If you are going to say no, well, give us a clear no. Don't keep us waiting. And then the next question was, you know, I'm paraphrasing what I've written. The next question was even more interesting. Are you a deity or are you a stone image? And then you see, my whole impulse was to, initial impulse was to burst out laughing. But then I sensed the mood of the villagers. They were in deadly earnest, you see. They had no doubt that they were conversing with a god. And no reply was given. And then somebody said they would come the following morning for a cold flower, you see. But they didn't. And we dispersed. But take this brief experience of mine. I don't think if you are brought up in an urban area, you would have any notion of it, you see. Or my other experience in Coorg, when I found this oracle who had been fasting for days, and the people knew his movements, you know, they as though it was, they read a script giving them his movements. They said he'll come and he'll put out this fire. And they saw a man in a white gown with an open Coorg sword in his hand. And then I remember the fire, which it was of really timber logs, and I couldn't stand. As the fire got going, I started, moving away from it. I measured it around, at about 10 feet, it was too hot for me to stand near it. So I moved away. This man came and with bare feet, he jumped and he almost stamped out the fire, you see. And then he went to the front of the temple, stood on the veranda, and then started gashing himself with the sword. And then I saw blood streaming. You know, it's a very unnerving sight. And then in emulation of him, the untouchable oracles below started gashing themselves. And then at the next moment, he was inside the main temple and outside the sanctum sanctorum. And there he was gashing himself. And then at one point, the young Brahmin priest of the temple came. And then he said, this man is supposed to be possessed by Bhadrakali. And this boy spoke in Kodagi. He said, we have had your visit. We hope you are not angry. You calm down now and leave us in peace, you see. And they gave the consecrated water. And the oracle took it, and then he subsides, he resumed his normal self. I mean, I think this would be an absolutely strange experience for most Indians. So the point I'm making is, India is so diverse and varied, regionally and sectorally or caste-wise and ethnic group-wise, that I don't think this argument about insider and outsider is...
But what about caste affiliation and so on? Those of us who even come from the outside find that once we start getting associated with a particular caste, we find we have limited access to other castes. Mm. Now, already coming in with a caste assignation of some sort, did you find that
actually what happened was that the villagers in Rampura made me behave like a Brahmin. Mm. You see, they found me a very, I would call myself a relaxed Brahmin. They thought I was, I was not really the thing. And the headman's daughter, the headman from the dominant Okaliga caste, his daughter, who was 10, was shocked about my indifference to pollution and purity, and she would go home and regale them with tales of my, you know, ignorance of these rules. And then, of course, they, you know, I couldn't have been a non-vegetarian in the village. And I had, when guests came from the city, the headman, you know, even as the jeep was coming in, the headman would have known the castes of, I mean, I'm exaggerating a bit, he would have known of the castes of the occupants or the passengers and tell me that I would be feeding the Brahmins and he would take care of the others. So it was there. And if I had rejected this role, my access to everybody would have been shut, you see. But on the other hand, I wanted to visit the Harijan area. And I asked the headman, because I knew I needed his permission to do anything. And if I had not asked him, I don't know, if I incurred his wrath, he could have me thrown out of the village within 24 hours, you see. He kept postponing it. So one day, after a while, I walked with my assistant to the Harijan area and sat at, in the veranda of every hut and, asked them about their genealogies, you know, their land and other data, their occupations, etc. Which really was a very lucky thing I did, because it made the untouchables feel that I was not a creature of the headman's, you see, that I was free. So I think you have to play it by ear. You cannot afford to displease the dominant caste, but also at some point, this is a matter for individual judgment, you should make everybody know that you are there to learn from everybody. And then here, there are certain idioms one has to use. The headman asked me one day, the headman was barely literate, he asked me, why are you collecting all this data? You know, he thought of me, you know, I could have been employed more usefully in the secretariat. Why are you doing this? I said, look, there are so many changes occurring in the lives of the villagers that I feel that, you know, that I should record them. Your grandchildren will probably find the village much changed. You know, suddenly, at once he replied, oh, you are doing something like the early Chinese travelers who have left records of India in the ancient days, you see. I was amazed at his perceptiveness. So, that you are a learner, that you are, and incidentally, it is in line with the Brahminical role, you see, to be a learner. And I also went around, at a certain stage, I got very interested in the settlement of disputes. And I went and told my young friends there, look, I want to be present at some disputes. I don't come to know about their occurrence. Will you teach me? So they took me in hand, you see. And their way of making me learn was, they would take me straight into a dispute, a street dispute, and say, these are the facts. As the dispute was going on, give your verdict. I would venture forth with with some answer. And at once they would shoot it down and start laughing, you see. This is, with all your degrees and so on, you are given such a foolish judgment. And, they would hide relevant facts from me, But after a while I realized it was a game that was being played in which they wanted to make me out to be a fool, you see. But as long as I was willing to go along with them in this game, I learned more and more about dispute settlement. And I found it very useful to play the role of the fool, you see. And in essence, I was. I knew very little about the village.
Carrie, I stole your question, sorry.
Well, my questions have been going to be more or less the same as yours, but I'll ask another one now. How important did you find it personally in doing your fieldwork to have close relations with one or two individuals who, or perhaps more than that, who would really give you a sort of psychological idea of what was happening there, as opposed to a more undifferentiated relationship with a lot of different people? Because I remember you wrote about this in your book, The Remembered Village. You described one or two people who were particularly important.
Yes. In essence, with the second man, my assistant, the man who appointed himself my assistant, I had no choice at all, you see. And he just came and appointed himself, and he proved to be extremely useful. He was, who is this man who
primitive man as philosopher. What's his name?
Radin.
Huh?
Paul Radin.
Radin. You know, the intellectual class. This man belonged to the intellectual class. He was curious about customs and so on. And he was also what the Americans would call an oddball. He didn't fit into village society. He had a low reputation. At the time I met him, I didn't know that, you see. He had squandered away his inheritance and was living on his wits. He was extremely useful to me, you see. He would give me a comment on what was going on behind the scenes. But then, after a while, I realized that he had his interest too. You see, the thing is, every man projects a view which is somehow related to not only his perceptions, he has interests, you see. And my friend Kulegowda, I would say that he on occasion promoted a dispute because he would get an opportunity to write documents and make some money and have influence with people and so on. This was one of his roles. But the other one, Nadugoda, the elder among the Okkaligars, he was extremely knowledgeable about village life. And he was also a great friend of mine. With all the three people, I was not only a learner, I had some kind of emotional bond with them. And I also had friendships in the village. And as you probably know by now, that you do not have any privacy in an Indian village, especially if you are a bachelor, as I then was. They were with me from morning till night. And all my notes had to be written while somebody looking over my shoulder. And it was only at night, I used to bolt my door and write under the light of two hurricane lanterns. Sometimes the headman would have borrowed one, you see, though I had to write under the light of one lantern. And one night I remember I was very tired and I was sleeping, or trying to sleep, when I got a knock on the door. And he kept on asking for me, Swami, Swami, and so on. Means, it's a respectful way of addressing a Brahmin, incidentally. I didn't answer because I wanted to sleep. And then he went round to the window on the side and peered through it and started shouting louder. After a while, I couldn't resist him. I opened the door. I thought there was some emergency and, maybe somebody was sick. And I used to have a lot of tablets and medicines for them. And I asked him, Iregoda, what do you want? He said, I was bored, I thought I would have some company. 10 o'clock, past 10. By 8:30, the villagers are asleep. And then we started talking. And then we got on to discussing a famous wrestling match in Mysore in the 20s. I'd heard about it as a boy, as a child. And I remembered, wasn't the name of the wrestler so-and-so. And then this man proceeded to show the wrestling trick which the local hero had used to defeat the champion from outside, from Hyderabad or somewhere. And then around 11 o'clock or so, he was holding me like this, hefty villager. And then after the social visit was over, I slept very soundly. So what I mean is, I have identified a disease, social claustrophobia, which hits everybody in an Indian village, if you are doing field work. And I used to sneak away on lonely walks, you see. And if it became unbearable, I'd go to Mysore for a day or so. I think you live very much at their mercy. I've heard of Africanists telling me that they would close their doors at 10 o'clock and type till late into the night. I don't think one could do it in an Indian village.
I don't know who these Africanists were. They were very lucky to have doors. In my experience, to close. Gordon.
You mentioned so that you made many friends in the village and that you had certain people with whom you exchanged a lot of information. But did you find that by making friendships with certain people, you alienated other people? And what did you do about that?
You see, this is a very good question, if I may say so. because I've heard social scientists, anthropologists saying that I kept so many families under observation, you see. In my case, the opposite was true. The headman had kept me under observation throughout, you see. Within a couple of hours of my leaving mine.
300 families were keeping you under observation.
He knew what had happened, whom I had met, roughly. And then earlier, before I settled down in the village, I had been told that this village had no factions. It was, and so on, all this stuff. Actually, I was, I thought for a while whether I should go to such an atypical village. If there were no factions, it would not be worth studying, you see. But very soon, within a few hours of my arrival, I knew there were factions. And one of the young faction leaders, he called himself a member of the Indian National Congress Party. He was one of the young Turks. He told me, you are staying near the headman, and doubtless he will tell you about what's going on in the village. It will be a very one-sided view of the village. If you are going to write a dispassionate account about our village, how do you make sure you will listen to everybody? I told him, I would like to talk to you very much. This is exactly what I come to this village for. When are you free? I would like an appointment with you. I think this disarmed him a bit, and he became a kind of friend of mine. But subtler than this was the fact that Nadugowda's sons were opposed to the headman and his rule, and they were leaders in a faction opposed to the headman, and they were some of my best informants and friends. And I used to go to them and I used to relax with them. The headman and his family were always, they were reserved. Whereas with this group, they were not so reserved. And I used to drink tea with them, go for long walks with them and so on. And the headman was always suspicious of my association with them. And he would ask me, question me on what we talked about and so on. I would tell him not the strict truth, you see, but something, we were talking about ritual and this and that. But once I really fell foul of the headman, and it was due entirely to my thoughtlessness. This was years after I had left the village. I was on a brief visit, and I think the normal caution which I exercised had left me. And one group of brothers were bitterly opposed to the headman. They said, the moment they saw me get off the bus, they said, will you come and photograph a part of the embankment of the village tank? It's very important to us, you see. I thought it was an innocent question. I went and took photographs, and they told me that the tank water had gushed through a hole and ruined their crop and so on. And they asked me to send photographs of the a breach in the embankment, etc., etc., which I promised to do. And then I went to pay my respects to the headman. The headman said, what have you been doing? He was very curt with me. What have you been doing? I said, I went to the tank and I've been photographed the embankment. And he said, do you know they are having a case against us? They have sued the panchayat for nuisance or something, and they are going to use you and your photographs as evidence against us. Do you think it's loyal on your part to do this to us, you see? It was comeuppance of the kind I had never thought would happen. And I at once apologized to him, and I told him that I would tear up the negatives, which I did. And so you have to be very, very careful in walking the edge of factionalism, as it were. It's a very real danger, you see. But on the other hand, the headman didn't mind or couldn't prevent me from being very friendly with the untouchables. There was one young rebel among the untouchables who was very witty, very articulate, and he used to give it to the landowners his landowner in a particular dispute I witnessed. He scored so many points that many landowners started admiring his, you know, his wit, his logic, and so on. This is another feature of Indian village life, that there is a certain aesthetic appreciation of disputes and arguments, and you know, and the man who argues cleverly is admired, and so on. So he didn't mind my going to different castes, but he certainly minded me going to the opposite faction.
So they received sort of warnings about problems for Western anthropologists moving upwards or downwards, and it is really not the thing. It's a question of moving sideways, yeah. Where the real problem lies, would you say?
I would say both ways. This is why one has to be continually, on the watch about how one behaves. One is supposed to be relaxing, but even one is relaxing with friends, one should be careful about what one says, you see. At any moment, you might hurt somebody, you see. It's really, there's no book which can help. I think it's some kind of increased sensitivity. I think this is why I found this, and the amount of data I had to collect and record. About once in between 4 to 6 weeks, I would have difficulties in sleeping. I would then go back to Mysore, probably sleep for a day or so, and then come back to see refresh. It is very, I don't know, Jack, what's your experience? I think one has to be on the alert all the time, and it's part of this train of field work, I would say.
Yes, it's true. Though I prefer it myself to other sorts of strain, such as I regard it as a pleasure.
Oh yes,
but to unfrequently indulge in.
Could I ask about another aspect of this being on your guard? It's again to do with the ethics of field work. There are two problems which I wondered whether you could comment on. One is, in the past, in a lot of the anthropology that was written by colonialists who went out to a place, they came back and they wrote about the natives, never expecting either to see the natives again, or certainly not expecting the natives to read their books. I wondered whether your situation, where you were very close in many ways to the people, and they were quite likely to be affected by what you wrote, and to read possibly what you wrote. You mentioned this Coorg return. Whether that affects much more how you report, because so much more has to be carefully weighed in terms of what effect it might have on the people. And the second question is that, and this is what is often seen as the central ethical question in anthropology, the manipulation of people as a source of data. In other words, I find even now, 10 years after having done field work in Nepal, when people from the field write to me, I get a peculiar sense of guilt, almost, that these are people who provided me with material for my own work. Often they write with requests which I'm unable to fulfill or don't feel I can fulfill well enough. But I'm a long way away, I'm thousands of miles away. I wondered whether the problem of both having people as friends and people who you enter into human relationships with, and also as people who are ultimately objects of study, is one which is greater for you.
In a sense, it imposed a terrible strain on me, because to regard Nadagowda or Kullegowda or the headman as only sources of data was aberrant to me, because they were human beings, and I had close and intimate links with them, as with my friends. But my role was that of the learner, and I had to I could ask them questions, and they liked teaching me. That's also another thing. But there is a seamy side to data. It was when asking about that I felt most uncomfortable, you see. For instance, a dispute would have taken place.
Seamy side. Yes, yes.
For instance, you know, who is sleeping with who, you see. Or did that man say that statement, make that statement because he had been spurned by that wife or widow, you see. I mean, this I found very unpleasant to ask. I would ask occasionally Kullegowda, you see. And he showed a reluctance to answer it. I mean, because in asking this question, I had somehow come down in his eyes, as it were, because he had the image of me as a scholar, as a decent human being, and to ask this question was a strain on me, and for him to answer itself was, was a strain, but sometimes he answered, sometimes he didn't. But then one problem, particularly when you are discussing intercaste relations, and as anyone who knows an Indian village, you hear stories about so-and-so being the keep of so-and-so and so on. You know, these stories are abundant. And either you say that these such rumors are widespread, or if you want to find out if it is really true, how do you do it, you see? I found asking these questions very unpleasant. And the only occasion I could ask such questions was from one of my friends when I was out on a walk with him. And then after we had talked about other things, to slowly turn the conversation around to this, I found... So the collection of information was unpleasant for me. And to this extent, I may have failed as a field worker, you see, that is one. And the second, I did find that my being friends with them minimized the manipulative element in my field work. And I would do errands, I would run errands for them, I'd give them gifts whenever I went to Mysore. I knew one of the things the village lacked was fresh vegetables and fruits. I would take fresh vegetables and fruits and distribute it among my friends. So, continually I would have this problem of how do I repay them? Am I doing the right thing? And I did try to help, but ultimately the question is that there is the question of manipulation. I mean, there's a fact of manipulation by the anthropologists of the indigenes. And and it's a very unpleasant affair, it is unpleasant for me, particularly because I feel I am very close to them. You see, I have some ideas for atoning for my sins, but that will have to be done in the future.
Marcus, were you going to ask about the ethics of fieldwork, or?
I was thinking more about the distancing effect, as it were. You were talking earlier with Stephen about sending out students into their own backyards, as it were, but you still make it apparent that they've got to go to a different culture area or language area. And you were saying that yourself, you went back to Mysore to sort of recuperate and sleep. Does anybody in India actually work literally with their own culture? Do you think that's possible or even desirable?
I think it is necessary at some point to look at your own culture. Because the anthropology can't always be of the other culture, you see. But to do your own culture calls for certain habits of mind and thought, this distancing of looking at your culture as a, as an outsider, I think has to be done, you see. I have... in a talk I gave, which was published selectively, it's distributed among a few people, I discussed the development of the field worker in the field. The first stage was bewilderment, once-bornness, I called it. And second stage, this great rapport which you think you have, I called twice-bornness, so much so that you look at the world from the point of view of the indigenes, and you think everything they do is right, and everything the outsider, the official, the visitor, or even you do is wrong, you see. But I think twice-bornness is not enough. It may be enough for a Brahmin, it's not enough for an anthropologist. He has to be thrice-born, and he has to go back and distance himself from the field. And one process, two necessary acts in distancing. One is to run away from the field, you see. Physical distancing is absolutely necessary. You must get away from that environment. And two, writing is distancing, you see. So the discipline of writing, and writing for an audience of anthropologists, each of whom has his own group and has done
or is about to do the distancing. I think these two are necessary. And after you have done probably one or two people, studies of one or two people, then you can take on your own culture, not before that, you see.
So you feel that fieldwork is, I mean, Peter Berger, for instance, has his idea of disillusioning, that as a sociologist you finally come to see your own society from outside, but he doesn't feel it's necessary to go off to New Guinea or somewhere before you can do that. So you would regard it as essential to leave your own culture before...
Not to go to New Guinea, you see. For instance, let me say, let me take up an area where I know nothing about and say, I think a middle-class student here could study a slum here. If you wanted to go to New Guinea, you can go to Leicester and study the Gujaratis. That would be a different kind of culture. So then he can go back and study his own people.
In fact, I'm going up to Leicester to study.
You are going up to Leicester. Doing the right thing.
Yes.
I'm glad you said that, right?
Well, Srinivas, do you find that if you're seeking explanation from your villages, you get different explanation from different people? And does that mean that you had to kind of work out the psychology of each informer before you can evaluate what exactly are they saying?
Not only psychology, you have to know his interests, his occupation, his land rights, his relations with his kinsfolk, his friends. Each statement comes from a particular personality and a whole matrix of context. So the explanation itself needs a comment and an explanation. Am I making sense? Or?
Yes, but like you mentioned about the fact that village headman said that there were no factions. Are there events which after a period they begin to deny that these happened and gloss over things so that it's presented in a very different way by the same people over time?
I think there are two or three things here. One, any outsider, when they are faced with any outsider, especially with an outsider whom they respect, the standard rhetoric is we have no factions. Because anything which does not create a positive image in your mind about the village, they would not tell you. In fact, within 2 days of my coming, I knew that somebody had set fire to somebody's hayrick. And the matter was mentioned in my presence, but when I tried to ask details about it, they just turned to some other topic. It was weeks later that I started coming to know about who had set fire to whose risk, hayrick and so on. And so the point is, gradually as you are absorbed into the village, then you are told more and more things. But even then, in the last analysis, they remember that you are an outsider. And they won't tell everything to you. Because of my many contacts and my friends amongst the younger villagers, and I think in a sense they meant it. I think there was a compliment implied in this. They said, as I was leaving the village, they said, "You know so much about our village, you can get every one of us into trouble, you see." So there is that fear also. On the one hand, they want to present a decent image of their village to you. On the other hand, if you know too much, then you can get them into trouble. For instance, there was not a single landowner who had not encroached on government land, you see. And I had land figures, I knew the survey numbers of each villager. I could say, where exactly they could have encroached upon. But they didn't know one thing. Even if I made a report about it, the government officials would know that this was universal and it was silly on their part to try and prevent this, you see. They would have that much sense, you see. I get it.
I wonder if I could take away from the problems of fieldwork, because get a group of anthropologists together and they always want to ask, really they're asking about their own experience rather than yours. I wondered if I could ask you what it was that led you into doing sociology in the first place, when you said you went to work with Gurye in Bombay.
at a purely secular rational level, I would say accident. By this I mean I was lucky enough to have malaria around the time I passed the matriculation exam, and I was thought to be very delicate by my family, and they said, this boy is not tough enough to do medicine, so let him go to the arts. That was one, you see.
Yes.
And second, after I passed my intermediate examination, and I didn't do very well in it for various reasons, my brother asked a friend of his, now look, what should Chamu do for the BA? That friend was a Marxist and an oddball, and he used to recite revolutionary Marxist songs on about Sacco and Vanzetti.
I recall them.
And he was a friend of my brother's. My brother had friends in all places. And he asked me to produce the handbook of the University of Mysore. And he went through the Be Honest courses. There was social philosophy. And it was an encyclopedic course designed by Anil Seel's grandfather, I suspect, or he had a hand in it. It included, apart from English and the second language, Kannada, Sanskrit, it included in the minor subjects social psychology, social anthropology, comparative political institutions and economics or something, comparative economics or something. And then as major subjects, philosophy of religion, political philosophy, ethics, history of ethics and political philosophy, Indian social institutions, Indian ethics, and essay or something, So my Acharya, that's what my brother's friend said, this is a very humanizing course, why don't you make him go through it? And my brother said, why don't you take it, remembering that I was too delicate to do medicine, So I went on to social philosophy. There I got really some kind of background, I won't say grounding, and it was there that I heard about Gurie and his eminence. And it was in my first or second year on the honors course that the names of Rivers, Malinowski and so on came familiar to me. And then I went to Gurie. Gurie was our examiner at the final year honors, and he had given me first class marks. And when I went to Gurie, normally you are not allowed to do a master's degree in sociology in Bombay without taking 8 papers over a period of 2 years. He said, you have covered the ground, so why don't you do some why don't you do it by dissertation? And this was due to the fact that Gurie didn't want me to waste my time, and also because he sensed that I had read too much theory and highfalutin things, and that I should be rooted in facts. And you know what he did? The first book he gave me to read was Habermas's Models in Evolution, which very nearly put me off sociology. Have you seen that book?
Yes, I...
Don't tell me you prescribe it.
Yes. I find other ways of boring the students.
Going back to those early times, you were doing your graduate work during a momentous period of Indian history, the gaining of independence. So was anthropology associated with the British Raj in any way? Was that a factor at all?
Yeah, the anthropology was, and the Indian nationalists were, members of the Indian National Congress were opposed to, ICS officials turned anthropologists. And at that time they were arguing for a separate status for tribals, the need for tribals to be protected from the Plains Hindus. And in the 1935 Act, there were two categories, one the scheduled castes, that is the untouchables, and the other the scheduled areas. And these areas were areas where the tribals lived. You'll be surprised to learn that about 18 miles from Bombay is Tana, where tribals live, the Warlis and others. That was excluded from the limited provincial autonomy offered under the 1935 Government of India Act. So Indian nationalists were opposed to anthropology. But, you know, Gurye himself...
They were opposed to setting aside these areas because they wanted it done on a
They thought it was
a
ruse of the rulers
to divide.
To keep the tribals to themselves. Gurye wrote a book based entirely on secondary sources on the scheduled tribes and their future. It showed that the problems of the tribals in many ways were similar to that those of the poorer peasants, and it didn't make sense to separate them. So that way he won acceptance at the hands of the Indian nationalists. Gurye didn't do it for a dishonest reason. I mean, Gurye would not do anything dishonest like that. He was really convinced that there was so much of tribal culture which was in common with the culture of the so-called lower groups and vice versa, that it was artificial to separate it, you see. So, and then there was Vaikunth Mehta, not Vaikunth Mehta, no, another person, Thakkar Bappa, whom Elvin also mentions, who had dedicated his life to working among the tribals. So, you know, there were both the nationalist approach to the tribal problem and the British approach to the tribal problem. So, there was this conflict between the two. And that conflict, in a sense, still continues, you see.
So when you came back to set up your first department, was there with a...
No, by that time things had changed. My job was to sell the idea of field work. And field work not in the sense of hit and run trips, you see, but really intensive field work. And I think, you know, I laid about it with a will, as they say. I made a lot of enemies. I was not discreet. I wrote polemical pieces criticizing armchair anthropology. Generally made a nuisance of myself. But I think it paid off in the end. And now, I mean, when I'm in a group in India, I take up the position that sociology is a field science. And I do it deliberately because knowing the habits of the Indian middle classes, I want to stress the need for them to go out and live with the... You know, with all kinds of groups.
Do you think it's a feature that's confined to the English middle classes in any way, Jamo? And you find them all around that don't know anything about the productive processes or anything like that. But tell me, would you say something about your going back? You went to Rampur in 47. 48 to 49, and you came back to Oxford.
January 14th or 15th. 49.
And you stayed in Oxford then for?
Until 51 June, when I got the chair in Baroda.
Yes. And then,
I
then
stayed in Baroda till...
Then you gave up the post, and your successor was Louis Dumont. I had to get that in.
And then David Pocock.
Yes. Well, and you went from Oxford to Baroda. And how long were you there, start working with the Institute?
You see, 8 years in Baroda. It's a story of my life, if I may say so. I stayed long enough in Baroda to get a few good teachers and to get a few good students. Arvind Shah and Narayan Sheth were both my students there. And both of them have chairs now. And then the University Grants Commission, which was set up in 53 or 54, I'm not certain about the date. They thought so highly of the department in Baroda. Suddenly, you know, things were happening in Baroda. They gave me money for new posts, scholarships for study, including at the PhD level, and then grants for a library, for enlarging the library, and also money for fieldwork, etc., and money for a new building. But then, 1959, February, I was in Delhi, because Dr. Rao invited me to the Delhi chair. And so, just when I could have settled down and really, you know, started doing my own work, I had to move to Delhi, where again the same situation, I had to start a new department. And Andre was one of my first students in, and first recruitments in Delhi. And in 9 years, the Delhi department, became so well known that we were made a center of advanced study for the teaching of sociology. And we then had 4 professors in the department, and the number of posts was increased. We got money for a new building. We got money for research, etc., and also money to attract students from all over India. But then in 72, I had to leave to start a new institute in Bangalore. And I spent 6 years, and then I gave it up because I felt I was becoming increasingly alienated from my studies. And now I have a Homi Bhabha Senior Fellowship, and I have an honorary fellowship at the Indian Institute of Management, and facilities to do my own work. And I'm slowly catching up with material. And a tremendous amount of new work has been done in India, exciting work. And I hope during the next few years I will catch up with it and be back in business, as it were. You see, too much of my time has been spent in teaching and in promoting the discipline, both in the university, inside university and outside, you see. So much so I don't want to look at a student now.
I noticed you looking the other way. But the institute you set up at Broda and the school and to Delhi, were they both combined anthropology, sociology departments?
In Delhi there was unfortunately already an anthropology department. I couldn't do anything about it. But I had friendly relations with them.
So you became professor of sociology.
Sociology. Yeah. But it did not prevent me from doing what I liked. For instance, in 1968 or so, the University Grants Commission requested me to start a program for the tribal people of northeastern hill region. That is to say the Khasis, the Garos, mm-hmm. the Pinar, and then Arunachal. We are getting students from those regions, and you are now getting members of these tribes becoming sociologists and occupying positions, teaching and other positions in their own areas. So this is one of the best things that happened, I think. And by and large, if you join the Delhi University Sociology Department, you can study a tribe, a temple town, an urban slum, a factory, anything, you know. So, and then the tribute to the department was paid by some members of the anthropology department who send their sons or daughters to study sociology in the Department of Sociology, you see. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. And that is... So it's partly for that reason that your students, many of them, have gone into a wide range mm-hmm. of fields. Have worked on trades unions and a whole range of activities of that kind.
The one who worked on trade unions has just been appointed to a chair in industrial relations in the Management Institute at Hyderabad. And I take it, vain that I am, I take it as a feather in my cap. But let me stress about one aspect of my work. I am not, I always feel mixed about, it is not easy to develop, not that India didn't have a tradition of work in sociology and anthropology, but I had a specific conception of sociology and social anthropology, and I had to promote this. And promoting it in a developing country, luckily for me, the University Grants Commission came, and the ICSSR, the Indian Council of Social Science Research, came, and it made it easier for me to do what I could for the disciplines. But in the process, I feel my own work and research and reading have suffered grievously. Sometimes I feel that I shouldn't regret it. Sometimes I feel I should regret it. You see? Mm-hmm. So this is a mixture of feeling. On the other hand, I'm quite certain that had I continued in Oxford,
I might have become a much better scholar. But on the other hand, I won't have the satisfactions that such as they are, which are mine today in seeing that anybody from Cambridge or Oxford or Harvard or Yale or Chicago can go to Delhi and have a thumping good discussion on any sociological or anthropological issue. That way, I feel my work has been rewarded. But I have regrets on the personal side. I don't know if I'm making sense to you.
As a student, I can say there'll be no regrets from the student side. We're very glad he stayed on.
But now that you've reorganized in your life in this way and have started reading all these books and so on, perhaps you'll send a few students to come and study, not with us in Cambridge, but perhaps study us in Cambridge.
Both. Both.
Hopefully.
Perhaps we ought to call it a day. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed.
May I divest myself?
Yes, you can take the...